This is Phil Farrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. We are now down to 1 week, basically. It's 5 days because June ends on a Monday this year. So I have 4 days next week, and then 1 day on the following Monday, then I go to halftime. So we are down to the final week, almost. So, yeah, that's different. So, while I will get back some of my time, and honestly, I've been kind of having to sit on myself a little bit because sometimes I'll glance at the clock and it will say 2:00 and I think, you know, I could be done for the day because it'll just be, and it's only 3 days a week, so it'll just be like 9 to 2 or 8:30 to 2:30, depending on the day. So I'm looking forward to this. It's going to be very, very different. It's been a good week. The guy I answer to, direct team lead above me, he was on vacation all week, so it was a pretty quiet week. We just puttered along with the things that we had to work on and got that stuff done and made progress. So it was good. It was good. The young man who'd come on to work with us, the young man we hired after Anthony had left, his name's Jack. He kind of did his first projects this week, kind of front to back, you know, just starting, getting them set up, getting the smart objects built, all that kind of stuff. Did a great job. It was great. So he got them all put together in a very reasonable amount of time, you know. And I went through and did a close check test on them, and they were good. You know, just a few little grimy things here and there. So he's working on getting those all corrected. And aside from that, you know, I thought he did a really good job. So yay. That's good. So writing is going fine. Just doing the read through on book 22 now. I'm up in chapter 22, I think, or chapter 21. So there's 30, 31, 32, 33 chapters, something like that, in this book. So I'm really hoping to get that finished up this weekend and then maybe get some files built so that I can start my read-through on book 23, get some files built, uploaded it to Kindle Direct Publishing, so I can start on book 23 and get that finished up. Start my read through on the first half that I already have written for that. So, and the read through is going fine. You know, it really helps me to do that, because now when I go back to read through book 23, I'll remember better what I had written in book 22. So I'll be able to drop, you know, right back into it, keep the continuity going. I feel like on book 23, I have a good handle on where I'm going. There's some things that have to get resolved still, and I have to kind of figure out how much of a backstory we're going to do in certain parts. And book 23 is the penultimate book of the third section of books, and in each case the penultimate book on the other sections, which are all 8 books long. So it would have been book 7 and book 15 and now book 23. They were all cliffhangers, but I think I've got that under control and I know what should happen there. So it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see. All the pieces are in the air, and we'll just see where this all lands. I think it'll be fine, though. I think, and, you know, then I'll be off to other books. So this has been a very interesting writing experience. So, you know, things are rounding down. Costuming is going fine. I'm still working on the Marvin the Martian helmet, redoing that, but I'm just painting now, so, and it's going to be fine. You know, it's not going to be the greatest thing in the world, and I'm sure there are cosplayers who could have done a much better job at this, but you know, it's fine. It's fine. So I am getting the hankering to do something more elaborate with EV foam and do something, you know, more awe-inspiring. So we'll see. I don't know where that'll all end up, but, you know, there are a lot of really cool patterns that are available and really cool stuff. So I think it would be fun, you know, to do some of that stuff. I just have to come up with a holiday. But of course, as soon as I get this helmet done, then I'm going to have to see if I can take a run at making a Mr. Potato Head. So we'll see how that goes. It's always interesting. It's always interesting. God is good. So yeah, ramping up for a big change. When I do the podcast next week, it'll be one day. Go in, work on Monday, and ta-da. So, yeah. Fun stuff. So this week I've actually had a research project that I've been doing. I listened to Jordan Peterson's podcast with Michael Saylor, I think. Is his name Sayer? One moment. Michael. Just a second. Hopefully this won't. Sometimes this gets a little persnickety. If I touch this too many times, then sometimes it says, you touched that too many times and you're supposed to be driving. Michael. One billionaire knows about outlasting a dollar collapse is the name of the podcast. Jordan Peterson. And this guy is a Bitcoin evangelist. I mean, he is all in on Bitcoin. But, you know, there are some pretty interesting things that are going on with Bitcoin. And I know I've told this story before, but it's been a while, and maybe Bitcoin appeals to me because of this story. But if I had been a bit wiser, honestly, I should have been sitting on a store of 25 Bitcoin at this point, and maybe more. But I'm not. I can't remember. I've told this story somewhere along the line. I'll give you the synopsis. So, years and years ago, when Bitcoin was around $70 a Bitcoin, I had heard about Bitcoin, and I thought, oh, okay, that's very interesting. The only place you could actually buy Bitcoin was on an exchange in Japan called Mt. Gox. And the reason it was called Mt. Gox is it had been connected to some online video game, something or other, and then they started trading in Bitcoin. Somehow they got hooked up to do that. And they were like the only place where you could exchange dollars for Bitcoin. And so I thought, well, shoot, why not? So I took $2,500. You had to wire transfer it to them. And honestly, I took out an account with them and I went and got the wire transfer done at my local credit union. And I thought, that's the end of that money. I am never going to see that again. lo and behold, a week later, I go into my account on Mt. Gox, and I've got $2,500 sitting in there. And I thought, okay, well, made it this far. And so then I bought a Bitcoin. And I thought, okay, well, I'm supposed to be able to transfer this down into a private wallet. So I got a little flash drive and installed the wallet software on it. And, you know, got the address for it. Went out to Mt. Gox and put in a transfer order, and sure enough, you know, multiple minutes later, I looked and it said that wallet had, you know, some money in it. And I was like, well, hey. So I had the technology available to actually build an offline wallet that I could have just, you know, kept. But I got seduced in by the fact that Bitcoin seemed to be going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. You know, it would be 70, it would get up to whatever, 110, 120, and then people would take profits, and then it would drop down to 70, and then it would go back up to 110, 120, you know, and it was just oscillating like that. And so I just got in the habit of, I think I started off with like buying 10 Bitcoin or something like that. And I waited for it to go up and then I sold it. And then I waited for it to come back down and then I sold it or bought it back. And then I waited for it to come up and I sold it. And within just a month or two or three months maybe, I had $2,400 cash in my account and I had 10 Bitcoin. Was it 10? Yes, I had 10 Bitcoin. And I thought, well, you know, here I've almost got all my money back and I've got 10 Bitcoins and they've in essence cost me $10 a piece. This is a pretty good deal. But what no one had told me and what I had not told myself, which was a mistake, was when you're day trading like that, you can be right 1,000 times in a row and all you have to do is be wrong once. And I got into it not to day trade, I just got seduced by the day trading. And really, I shouldn't have been day trading all that kind of stuff, but really, as soon as I had pretty well made my money back, what I should have done is just taken those 10 Bitcoin, transformed them into my private wallet, and then, you know, taking the $2,400 and just bought as much Bitcoin as I could at that point and then transferred that into my wallet. And if I had done that when the $2,500 first hit, it was, Bitcoin was trading around $75.80. So, you know, I could have bought somewhere in the region of 30 plus Bitcoin. And I should have just transferred as soon as I knew what I had and then just sat on it. But I didn't. So Bitcoin then got up to like $300. And I thought, well, shoot, that's going to be, you know, it's going to come back down at that point. And so I sold out. And so I had $5,400 sitting in my Mt. Gox account. And then Bitcoin just kept going up because Chinese investors had gone in at that point. And so it pretty much got up to 1,000 and just hung around there. And I got to the place after a couple of months where I thought, you know what, you just need to convert whatever cash you've got to Bitcoin, transfer them out, just need to be done. And while I was talking myself into that, because I thought it's not coming back down, then Mt. Gox went out of business. So that's my history. That's my Bitcoin story. Now, who knows? If I had actually done what I intended to do and I had, you know, 30 Bitcoin on a flash drive, the stories are many and multitude of people who forgot their passwords, lost the flash drives, crashed the computer. I certainly don't have a story like the one guy who I talked about at one point on this podcast, who had a hard drive where he had mined all these Bitcoins. Last time I heard, he had mined enough that hard drive would have been worth like $288 million. And he had an old hard drive he was going to throw away, and he got the two confused, and he threw away the one with the Bitcoin on it. That's a sad day. And he tried so hard to get the city let him go and excavate in the city dump, and the city was just like, nope, we're not doing that. I mean, he offered to, like, give the city a hefty sum of it if he could find the hard drive, you know, give everybody in the city so many dollars if they'd help him find. Nope, nope. City just went, nope. Yeah, that really stings. So my story isn't that bad, but is bad enough. So maybe I've always kind of been looking at Bitcoin and thinking, is there a way for me to redeem myself here? But I have to say, after listening to Michael Saylor, and I would recommend that you go listen to it, because Bitcoin is at a very interesting place. There had been a lot of speculation, and in fact, Michael Saylor himself, I think back in 2013, which, by the way, he is a tech billionaire guy, built his own company, was competing directly with Microsoft and the Big Seven and all that kind of stuff with a product that they had produced, and, you know, had been very successful in that. But COVID was hitting, and all his talent, everybody was working from home, and he knew all his talent was going to end up being poached by Microsoft and Amazon and that sort of thing, and he was fighting it tooth and claw for years and years and years, and he had just gotten to the place where he said they were growing like 2-3% a year, but it wasn't. He was just kind of disappointed he wasn't up in the upper echelons of all that. And so he was looking around. He had seen Bitcoin earlier, and he thought, well, that's interesting, but, you know, the governments are going to shut this down. And he had a famous tweet in 2013 where he said, there's no way this thing is going to survive because the governments are just going to shut this down because this is a replacement for their fiat currency. So, well, I think it was in 2020, with COVID coming on, then he called up a buddy and said, so tell me about this Bitcoin thing again, because he was looking for something. And so after much looking and much research and much thinking and much, you know, trying to figure out exactly what Bitcoin was, he decided that he was going to take, I don't know what it was, $220 million out of the coffers of his company, and he was going to buy Bitcoin. And at the time, it was the largest institutional sale of all time of Bitcoin. For those of you who don't know, which I can't imagine there will be many who don't know, Bitcoin is a very clever way to create a blockchain, it's called, of transactions. And the only way you can get new blocks into this chain is by mining them and solving difficult mathematical problems. And for that, the miners get reimbursed in Bitcoin so that there can be more transactions, and they get to charge a little fee for transferring information in and out of the blockchain. It is a completely distributed network. There is no single governing entity in Bitcoin, which becomes important in a minute. So Bitcoin at this point, last I heard, it's 18,000, 19,000, 18,000, somewhere in there. Computers that are all running the Bitcoin software that has to conform to a certain standard. They all keep a copy of the blockchain on them. And those copies are all validated because it's all cryptographically hashed and all that sort of thing. And so when you put a computer on the blockchain, it becomes a node, and that gives you voting rights. And so any proposed changes to Bitcoin have to be voted on by at least 50%. And Bitcoin has survived a great revolution. So I guess there was a desire by many, many of the people on the blockchain to increase the size of the block. And the majority said no. And so that led to a new fork of the software. And then people chose whether or not they were going to run the new fork or whether they were going to run the old fork. And so Bitcoin became Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash. And Bitcoin Cash hasn't done nearly as well as Bitcoin continues to do, because it is a protocol that is designed to have a fixed amount of Bitcoins ever mined, and we're reaching that limit point. The expectation is that it will take somewhere between 40 and 100 years to finish up mining all of them, because it just keeps getting, by design, more and more and more difficult to create new blocks on the blockchain. So, at this point, there's something like 19 million Bitcoin. Interestingly, supposedly the guy who invented this, Satoshi somebody or other, Nakamoto, Satoshi, I don't know. He mined it for a while, or the team of people who call himself that mined it for a while, and they have like a million Bitcoin. They have an address where a million Bitcoin are stored right down at the base of the blockchain. Which a million Bitcoin at this point is worth a lot of money, because they're worth over $100,000 a Bitcoin. And if you have a million of them down there, that ends up being what? $1 trillion? That's a lot of money. So basically, if Satoshi ever came forward, he would instantly be the richest man in the world. But up to this point, no one has come forward to claim that they're Satoshi. So either Satoshi died, or he wants anonymity, and there have been no transactions against that wallet. So it's really interesting. Michael Saylor makes the point that Bitcoin is a store of value. For a while there, people were trying to figure out, so is it a store of value, or is it just how people buy and sell outside any fiat currency? And there are many cryptographic coins that are trying to be in that space. But Bitcoin is not worried about being in that space, and it's really settled in on a store of value, digital gold, some people call it. But there are ways in which it is better. than digital gold, than just gold. So Michael Saylor will say that fiat currency, currencies that are issued by governments, on average, lose 95-97% of their value over 100 years. Because of the printing of more money, you know, we're losing 7% a year of the value on the dollar. Of course, the federal government is $36,000 in debt. $36 trillion in debt, not thousand. So it's very interesting. And one of the key things that has happened, according to Michael Saylor and according to other people I've listened to over this past week, is that the government did finally decide how they were going to treat Bitcoin. And they decided to treat it not as a security, but they decided to treat it as a commodity, which means you don't have to pay taxes on your gains until you sell, which is really important. Because that put it in the same realm as gold and land and, you know, those types of things. And it's just very interesting. And I understand it's, you know, it's $100,000 a Bitcoin at this point, but you can buy it in increments and you can just put in the amount of money that you want to spend and you get that increment. And the expectation is, well, the other thing that's happening now is that there are, I think they call them EFTs, based entirely on Bitcoin. And in fact, Michael Sayer, they're issuing stock based on their holdings because when they bought into Bitcoin, it was like, I think $30,000 a coin, and now it's $100,000 a coin. And so just in the last 4 or 5 years, they've actually tripled their money. And there's not really any indication that it's going to slow down because Donald Trump has been talking about having a Bitcoin reserve just like you have a gold reserve. It is a really interesting technology. It's never been hacked. That's not to say it couldn't be hacked, but it's completely distributed. So, you know, if you had some sort of solar flare that knocked out half the planet, you're still going to have computers around that'll have copies of that blockchain on it. It's just very interesting. I do know this, that if you have a scarce resource and then you start having countries stockpiling Bitcoin because they've realized this is a maturing technology that has survived all sorts of assaults, and it's been in existence for 15 years now. So if people start really buying in, both in business and in governments, it's going to make it harder and harder and harder for the individual person to actually buy Bitcoin. And it's going to drive the price up. And it's decoupled from the dollar, and I think you could even make a case that as opposed to the dollar being the fiat currency of the world that everybody bases their stuff on it, there may be a future point where that's actually Bitcoin. It's just very, very interesting. Now, it is... it is the Wild Wild West. I mean, it's because there are no guarantees and there are no reprieves. The technology is a mature technology, but hackers are just using all sorts of methods. And there are all sorts of stories of people who bought Bitcoin 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you know, and now they're like, woohoo, and they were ready to cash out. And then they can't remember their passwords. They have developed technologies since I was involved with it. Things like they have these passphrases, no, not passphrases, but what do they call them? A seed phrase, where you can generate a seed phrase of either 12 or 24 words. And then that seed phrase becomes the way to recover that wallet if something goes wrong. But that seed phrase is also the way for people just to rip you off. So, you know, they say, first of all, don't store your money in an exchange. Don't store your Bitcoin in an exchange. Store it in a wallet. And then there's soft wallets or hot wallets, they call them, where you just run a program on your computer or your phone and, you know, they're free. And they're reputable, but they make a little cut on all the transactions you do. But it is on your phone and your computer. So if you get a virus or some way to get somebody have control of your computer, they're going to sweep through your computer looking for those programs and then hack into your wallet, and they're just going to empty it. And as soon as they get that address and get access to it to where they can do a withdrawal, they transfer it out and it's gone. There's nothing you can do to get it back. I mean, it's just like having a physical asset like gold. If somebody gets into your house, figures out where you've got your gold stored, they walk out the door, that's it. It's just like that. And then there's hard wallets or cold storage, they call it. You know, it's all just fascinating technology. So I don't know. I don't know, but it's really interesting. So, you know, if you don't have nothing to do for dozens and dozens of hours, it could very well be that we're at an inflection point with Bitcoin. And the last 15 years have been nothing more than a proof of concept. And now that there's a proof of concept, we're about to see something very interesting happen. So, I don't know. There are people predicting that within just a couple of years, Bitcoin's going to go to 200. Michael Saylor thinks that in 15 years, Bitcoin will be at 13 million a coin. He's got all these facts and figures and, you know, so we might look back at all this and think that this was the beginning of something fundamental happening. I mean, never in my wildest dreams, when Bitcoin was 70 or 80, people were talking about Bitcoin going to 1,000. It's going to go to 1,000. Everybody's like, you're crazy. It won't go to 1,000, you know. And now it's at 100,000. So, yeah. Sure would have been good if I hadn't fiddle-faddled around with it back when it was 70. But water under the bridge, easy come, easy go. You know, it'll just be very, very interesting to watch. So you might do a little research. See if anything there strikes your fancy. It is very, very fascinating. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.